We city folk have learned to eat skinless, boneless breasts from factory farm chickens and think ourselves intelligent for doing so. This leads us to ask, what happened to the joy of eating?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 537th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Sasebo who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Dave Michaels on the boards. Hello, Dave.
Glad to be here.
Producer Carol Stafford is out at the annual Thomas Jefferson Waffle Breakfast, whatever that is. But we do have producer Kelsey Olson in from college to take over the phone duty today. Hello, Kelsey.
Good morning.
Folks, we have become a bit sensitive about eating these days. So sensitive, in fact, that we now dine on skinless, boneless chicken breasts from factories 2,000 miles away and think ourselves intelligent for doing so. This leads us to ask, what on earth happened to the joy of eating? With us today to help explore this question, we have the perfect guest, the sage of Dannebrog himself, Roger Welsh, anthropologist and author of Digging In and Pigging Out. Welcome to the Food Chain. Welcome back, I guess, Roger.
Well, thank you, but, Mike, I thought we were friends. And then you make me sit here and listen to that weather report.
Well, tell us about spring in the heartland today.
That was painful. Well, we're in for our usual spring disappointment here. When everything starts to bud, the wild plums were just blooming, the lilacs were just getting ready to pop, and now we've had 5 days in a row with temperatures below 20 every night. Everything has turned black, died, and fallen off the stems.
What happens when a false spring happens like that? Does spring come back?
Some of it does, but, you know, the lilacs won't bloom this year. I used to be on CBS Sunday Morning with Charles Gralt, right. And I got in trouble one time for telling a story about every damn spring it happens, my lilacs freeze and die. And, of course, Gralt was inundated with letters from people who were unhappy because I had said damn on a Sunday morning. And he said, well, but you know, when your lilacs freeze, that language isn't even tough enough.
Doesn't come close, does it? You know, and for people who live on the temperate climates of the coast, it's hard to imagine the impact of spring in the Midwest and the Heartland. I was raised in Montana, and I remember those spring mornings, like, because it hits you like somebody punches you in the nose with a big, huge, soft pillow. It's just pow, all of a sudden it's spring. You know, it's there, and the lilacs pop out, and the bouquet of them can be smelled down the street, and it's just people dancing down the street. It's really something to see.
Well, there are all kinds of senses that, and it's one of the things I love about living in Nebraska, as nasty as I make it sound, is that there are seasons. And here, we're Dannebrog, Nebraska, which is the center of Western civilization, I guess you probably know that, is just north of Grand Island, right smack in the middle of Nebraska, right smack in the middle of the United States.
Right.
And we're right under the flyway. So our real signs of spring are at night when you can hear the geese flying over headed north. And right now, the sandhill cranes by the millions are gathering in Grand Island and starting to head north. And so we not only have the smell of the plant starting to come up, the smell of fields being plowed, which is also just a perfume.
Oh, boy.
But the sights of plums starting to bloom, lilacs, but the sound, too, of spring overhead. I love it.
Yeah, miss it myself. Well, let me ask you this. How did a respectable journalist, a professor, and a veteran of CBS Sunday Morning come to write a book entitled Digging In and Pigging Out?
Well, I've never been respectable. We can start with that. I enjoy eating. If you were to see me, you would see that I am a walking advertisement for American agriculture. I don't trust skinny politicians because it doesn't doesn't seem to me like they're supporting American agriculture.
I
enjoy eating, and I think that is the clue. It's not so much a matter of eating a lot, but a matter of thinking about what we're eating and enjoying it. And America seems to have lost that joy. We just scarf this stuff down without thinking about it. You know, I see people driving and eating at the same time,
right,
while everybody else is worried about people being distracted from their driving. I'm worried about them being distracted from their eating. I think they ought to take more time to think about these things. It's almost spiritual, you know. I spend a lot of time among Native Americans, and there's a lot of thought given to what goes into our food, the things that die, let's face it. Well, even if you drink a can of beer, things died to make that can of beer.
Right, right.
And we need to think about that and give thanks to those things that have that nourish us. And we don't think about much of anything. As far as I'm concerned, the one good thing about fast food is that we eat it with our fingers. So that does add a sense the sense of feel to the everything else that goes into eating. And so I do appreciate that part of it. I wish
there is at least that, right? There is at least our fingers.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you think we can find true joy in eating skinless, boneless chicken breasts that have been produced in some factory thousands of miles away?
I think it can happen. You know, I think I told you in our earlier conversation when we were talking about getting together this morning, that this, after all, is a singular weekend to talk about food and gluttonizing, if that's
right,
the phrase, because it's, after all, Easter weekend and the end of Lent and the time when a lot of people are giving up things. And I told you about how we've laughed here that during Lent in this area they have had all-you-can-eat fish fries on Friday night. It seems to me all-you-can-eat is the antithesis of Lent, and then with a brownie dessert.
There you go.
You know? But
so you can give things up, but you don't have to give up a lot, right?
Yeah, but one of my friends always says that what he gives up for Lent is cold, lumpy gravy.
There you go.
And yeah, it's pretty easy. But, you know, my wife is Catholic, and in their family it was traditional to have a fish, sometimes even just things like fish sticks, creamed peas, potatoes, salmon patties, perhaps, on Friday night.
Right.
And when that started, and when we got married 26 years ago, I thought, oh, my God, what have I let myself in for every Friday night? Salmon patties, canned creamed peas. But I should have known better, because in this book, what I'm talking about really is the meaning of food. And what has happened to me, while I haven't converted to Catholicism, I've converted to what I think is a really delightful tradition of that Friday night meal, which she grew up with, which is traditional within her family, is now traditional in ours. And frankly, you know, you and I have talked about this before. Food is, we don't eat what we eat because it's good for us, because it's nutritional, because it's convenient, because it's economical. None of those things. We eat what we eat for the meaning. And that Friday night meal, as uninteresting as it may sound to anybody else, and as it certainly sounded to me, has really become a rather pleasant little spot of consistency in a life of turmoil, in a world of turmoil.
And so it's really the tradition, isn't it?
I think
all that tradition embodies the family structure, the love between a husband and a wife, and an extended family, perhaps.
And I think that, you know, a butterball turkey on Thanksgiving may strike a lot of people as being really pretty dreadful kind of fare. But it isn't really, because it's the ritual that goes with Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. It's the idea of the entire nation sitting down and eating the same meal at the same time that has its meaning. And I think that's what gives the food its flavor.
Wow. Well, of course, you do have a way of sticking your feet into the honey bucket, and one of the ways that you did it in this book is to assert that there is a difference between men and women when it comes to food, because you talk a lot about the notion of man food. What exactly do you mean by man food?
Oh, boy, what exactly?
Here we go, right?
Man food. Yeah, I know, because it's sort of like art. You know, I know it when I see it, or pornography. I know man food. Around our house, at least, I can, for one thing, eat a meal without dirtying a dish. I can eat out of the can. I can balance a sandwich on my overall knees, and I eat with my fingers. And often Linda will be gone for a week, and there's only one fork in the sink to show evidence of the fact that I've eaten it all for a week. Whereas when she'll make a grilled cheese sandwich and the dishes fill the sink. It's amazing to me. She seems to, I think, maybe color coordinate or something. What I tend to do is go with my feelings, which doesn't sound very manly, I suppose.
It doesn't. That sounds so womanly.
To read your emotions. But I know my daughter, I think, summed it up very well one time when I came out of the kitchen with what we have find your own meals, which means I get to choose whatever I want. I love a find your own meal. So I think I had some pickled smoked eel.
Wait a minute. Hold that. We're going to come right back.
Okay.
This is the Food Chain.
Well,
Michael Olson.
Leave them with pickled smoked eel.
Leave them with pickled here. We'll be right back. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Your chance to speak with Robert Welsh. Do stay tuned. Welcome back, folks. This is the Food Chain. Today we're having a little fun because it is holiday season and it's time to have a little fun, relax a little bit. And we're relaxing today with the sage of Dannebrog, Nebraska, Roger Welsh. You know him, of course, from CBS Sunday Morning with Charles Carroll, the wonderful wit and wisdom from the country's heartland. And today we have him on the Food Chain and we're talking about digging in and pigging out. And we're talking about finding the joy of eating it again. And we were talking a little bit about how we tend to lose that joy in the speed with which we have taken to eating. We eat our foods now, driving down the highway and running from one place to the other, and we somehow find it hard to enjoy that kind of stuff, and we pick up the weight and don't get much nutrition, and where's the joy in that? So we're visiting with Roger Welsh, looking for the joy, and if anybody can find joy in eating, it's Roger Welsh. Roger, we were talking about man food versus woman food, and you're talking a little bit about pickled what?
Well put. We were talking about my daughter observing me one time in my free grazing mode, and I went into our larder. We have a closet where I get to store my food. I came out with some.
Oh, wait a minute. You store your food?
Yeah. Linda has her own place. I have mine, and she generally looks at my little cache of food and shudders. Sees what I have, because I pick up things that I think look good or interesting or even adventurous. And I think that's another thing that's lost in our food and eating the stuff that tastes the same from every drive-in to the next drive-in. I like to try stuff that's very, very different. So I came out of this little room of ours one time with a plate, and I had some smoked eel from Denmark, I believe it was, and some feta cheese from Greece, and some Swedish flatbread, and maybe some kimchi on toast, which I love. And Antonia, our daughter, looked at me with horror and said, "Dad, how do you decide what to eat?" And I thought that was a great question, because I don't know. I guess I look and I think, well, that looks good, and ooh, that I remember that. That looks good, and I'll try this. The idea of a balanced diet or a color-coordinated plate never crosses my mind. I like to eat what I think is good.
Well, do you think there's a relationship between what you think is good and what is good? You know, one is called to mind pregnant women and their passion for weird foods like pickles or what have you. Don't you think that their bodies are telling them that they need a specific nutrient and those things taste good, and the reason they taste good is because there's a need for those nutrients?
There's not a doubt in my mind, Mike, that that's the case. I think men are more in touch with their inner caveman in that regard.
That's a safe statement, I guess.
As I mentioned, I spent a lot of time with Native Americans in this area. And in the old days, they didn't have the option of going into a larder and deciding what they were going to eat. They ate what was available at that time of the year. And I like to think of nutrition as strategic rather than tactical. You don't eat every meal as a balanced diet. You eat over the year. What is, and when I'm out here in my yard and I walk by our garlic chives, which I love, and I get an urge to eat a bunch of garlic chives, I pick and eat garlic chives. I'm sure it's speaking to a need. One of the things that always fascinated me in reading, for example, about Plains buffalo hunters, the Indians, was that one of the treats for children was a bit of raw intestine dipped in bile of a freshly killed buffalo. And I always thought, well, now there's probably something I'm never going to find on the menu at Denny's or right. Carlos O'Kelly's. So I'm going to try that because there are people who grow buffalo around here, and I know people who grow buffalo. And so I could get a chance to do that. So over the years, I kept asking people, and finally, one year, I had a chance to try
it. Wait a minute. What did you ask them? I have to hear your question.
You're right. That's a very good question, because probably the first three people looked at me peculiarly, put their finger on the dial to call me and be involuntarily committed. But some people were probably curious enough just to see if I would actually do it, you know, the fear factor notion. That one of them finally said, okay. And they did it, and I've eaten buffalo intestine before. It's considered a delicacy with Plains Indians, like mm-hmm. menudo. So, but this time I got a chance to also try the bile. It was very bland. It was not particularly interesting. But then I started thinking exactly as you did. I'll bet that after a winter of eating dried pumpkin, dried corn,
pemmican, yep.
What do you have? Right, pemmican, some squash, maybe beans. There must have been something in a child's diet that or their metabolism that screamed out for whatever there is in raw intestine and bile that probably satisfied some nutritional need. It was not objectionable to me, but it just wasn't particularly interesting.
Well, it calls to mind stories I've read of mountain men and the joy they had in eating marrow bones in a cold winter night, you know, of roasting bones over the fire and breaking them open and consuming the hot marrow therein and taking such joy in that.
You know, I tried something close to that one time. I had always heard in regard to the trappers and traders who passed through very close to here on the Platte River, as it was called then, the Nebraska, headed out into the beaver country and also trapping around here, that one of the delicacies was beaver tail. And they would just put beaver tail up close to a fire where the skin blisters and pulls right off the insides, and it was considered a real delicacy. And I thought, a friend of mine was doing some trapping around here, and I asked him, and he said, sure, again, looking at me rather strangely, that he would save a beaver tail for me. And so my son and I were down here at our cabin by the river, and I did exactly like the descriptions told. I put it up close to the fire, blistered skin off, the inside cooked rather nicely, and then we tried it, and it was absolutely dreadful. It was very fatty, very fishy, not really very good, but again, as you say, I'll bet when you needed a high energy food, when you were out in the cold all the time, when you had so little other fare, it tasted darn good when you were one of those trappers.
You know, you taught anthropology, right?
English and anthropology.
And a lot of what you did with respect to anthropology is look at the relationship of people and their foods, especially the pioneering kinds of folks. What relationship did they have? Did they take great joy in their eating like you do?
Well, I think they always say, you know, that hunger is the best seasoning, and I think they had plenty of that to go around.
Plenty of that to go around.
But one of the things that has always struck me about frontiersmen out here on the plains, at least, was again their lack of interest in heading in other directions. They came out here and felt like they were conquering the plains. They were struggling against the elements, that they were eking out a living, while all around them, the Pawnee in this area, the Lakota, the Omaha Indians, were doing just fine. They had an abundance of food. They had a veritable grocery store growing around them. But the white settlers, not just whites, but non-Indian settlers, were not interested in trying native foods because they were low status. On those few occasions when they would try gathering wild foods, plant foods in particular, they even wrote in their journals that the food was very good, but they were worried about somebody coming in and seeing them eating these right. Indian foods that were such low status.
Didn't that have something to do with being sedentary as well? I mean, the Indians were migratory. They would follow the food, and the settlers were settling. I mean, they were plunking themselves down and saying, here we stand.
There's a lot of elements involved in that. The Pawnee and Omaha were essentially farmers, although they did go on two yearly hunts, annual hunts for buffalo. But essentially, they were city dwellers. So the Lakota were real hunters. They
okay,
were nomadic.
We're going to have to take a quick break, Roger. Folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here with Roger Welsh, the sage of Dannebrog. We're talking food. When we get back, we're going to talk about men cooks and women cooks and men's kitchens and women's kitchens and making hams and all kinds of great things. Do stay tuned. Well, I don't know, but I think back on the history of the United States and the history of this continent, I think the apogee of American civilization came right after the Plains Indians got the horse and before the white man showed up. I just think it must have been great eating back then. What do you think, Roger?
I think so, too. I know that Indian fare, of course, there were hardships later on when the buffalo were gone.
Well, I meant before the white man came.
Oh, yeah.
And after the horse showed up, you know.
I'm not sure I would want to live during that time because of the disease, the short. But, you know, we only live with what we know. And I suppose someday some people will look back and think how sad it was that we only had, what, 65, 70 years. But I think so, too, especially here on the plains where they did have very comfortable houses. They had earth lodges that were comfortable summer and winter. They had good crops. They had many different kinds of corn, squash, and beans. They had plenty of game, plenty of fish. And they had plenty of time, therefore, for all of the other things that go with culture, with storytelling, with art.
Right.
And people wonder, how could they possibly have the time to develop these intricate, complicated story cycles while they were fighting for food? Well, they weren't fighting for food. A woman could go out and provide enough food for her family in a very short period of time because she knew what to eat, she knew where it was, and she knew when it was available.
She knew how to cope with the seasons and what foods were available when and where they were. And you talked about the time. And isn't that what we're really lacking now? And what impact does that have on our ability to enjoy eating?
I think, though, that we fool ourselves. We talk about time-saving devices, which we wind up having to work
like
an extra
fast
2 hours
food, right?
a day to afford, you know, which doesn't amount to anything. It's a matter of taking time. I think we can eat on the run and in the car, or we really can just take a little bit of food, sit down, sit outside, maybe even outside an office building, and enjoy the outdoors and eat a little bit more slowly without the panic that seems to be involved with getting enough nutrition to make it through till the evening.
And that makes a big difference in our culture, too, doesn't it?
It sure does, because eating with that kind not leisure, because it's much more necessary than leisure, but by taking our time, thinking about our food, enjoying our food, I believe, and I don't want to get too evangelical here, but I think it puts us in spiritual touch with our food and with all of the things that provide us with food, which means with life.
Well, you know, in your book, Digging In and Pigging Out, it always seems like your best meals are stories about the meals you share with people and the great conversations that are involved and the great just the communication. And how can you do that when you're flying down the freeway with a hamburger in one hand and a cell phone in the other and your steering wheel in between your knees?
In those cases, it really doesn't even matter what you're eating. I have a little cabin down here by the Loop River, and it's a beautiful place, quiet, back in the trees, and nights down there are just gorgeous. And I know that if I'm sitting down there with Linda or with a couple of buddies, and we're just sitting around the fire, maybe burning some sausages over the fire, even if it's just nothing more than that, and maybe rolled up in some plain white bread, nonetheless, the society of it, the conversation, the taking our time, really is what adds the relish to the food.
I remember as a young boy scout being on a camping trip and living out of man food, what you call cans of pork and beans and whatnots. But this one kid had, his mother had prepared him the makings for some bread. And he made this bread dough, and we were all watching him, and he wrapped it around a stick and kind of roasted it over the fire while we're all sitting around the fire looking at him, right? And he took out some butter, and he basted the outside of it. So by the time this bread was done cooking, all of us were just like falling all over ourselves to get a piece of it, you know? And it was no doubt the best-tasting bread I've ever had in my life, but what made it so good wasn't really the bread itself, but the act of preparing it and the showmanship and the situation, the set and the setting there.
Well, that's exactly the key, is transforming anything from the item to the process. My wife is an artist. She's a painter, and she's incredibly talented. And one of the real joys of my life in the 26 years we've been married, is that what she has given me in being able not to see art as something hanging on the wall, but a process from the very conception through all of the revisions to the layers of oil to all of to the thought that goes into a painting, so that I can see art from my perspective now as a process rather than an item. And you mentioned the hams, and that's one of the things that I learned early on. My children, we were eating pork one night, and one of my kids said, "You know, what's a pork?" And in English, we can conceal what it is we're eating because of our linguistic trickery of describing what we eat in French and what we grow in Anglo-Saxon. So we grow swine and we eat pork. And so I thought, you know, these kids need to know what it is we're eating because they owe it to the pig. And I really believe that.
Wow, that's very Indian of you, isn't it?
Two of them grew up to be vegetarians. After the first time we butchered a hog and scraped a hog and cured all the meat and everything, that did it for them.
That was it.
But for me, making the hams is like the creation of the art. It not only, of course, are homemade hams cured and smoked in my smokehouse with my cobs and my wood, much, much better than anything I could buy, but being involved in the process, you know, going down to the smokehouse for a week at a time, three or four times a day, to put some more apple wood or corn cobs on the smudge and to look at those hams hanging there, you know, it's mm-hmm. a thrill. It's really the best part of the ham.
Let me ask you this. Does that knowledge get imparted to the people to whom you give those hams? I mean, I know you give them away as Christmas presents, but do the people you give them to know what went into the hams?
Oh, I think so, because cooking up a ham that's been home cured over apple and cobs, you don't cook that without knowing exactly what's happened to it. The house, suddenly, the house and maybe 100 yards in every direction becomes absolutely perfumed with a wonderful smell of that smoke and the days and days that it spent hanging in that smokehouse. There's not much question that something went into that ham that they sure don't get in a can in a grocery store.
Well, good. That's one of the things I want to pick up when we come back. I want to ask you about that disconnect that we city people have with the processes that have gone into our food. You know, I jokingly referred to the fact that we've come to eat these boneless, skinless chicken breasts that come from factories 2,000 miles away. And I just go back to the fact that we don't know. We've lost track of what went into the making of our food. And can we enjoy that food to the extent that your friends can, your hams? Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking Digging In and Pigging Out with Roger Welsh, who is the author of Digging In and Pigging Out. And you, if you'd like to speak with Roger, pick up your phone and join us. 800-624-2665, 831-4790. Right back.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, a few years ago, I was out visiting Farmer Joel Salatin in the Shenandoah River Valley of Virginia, and Joel was harvesting his chickens, bushing his chickens and freezing them and selling them to people from the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area who drove 100 miles or so to buy his chickens. And I was, as I was watching this transaction, these line of cars pulling in, people buying chickens from Joel, and I was looking at these big, beautiful roasting chickens, and I got to thinking, got to bring some of those back to California with me. And I was walking back and forth trying to puzzle over how I was going to stick some of these chickens in my suitcase and fly them back. And my common sense finally came in and said, "Well, you dummy, you can't do that, but you can enjoy a wonderful meal with the Salatins and carry that with you." And I get to thinking that knowing something about the processes involved in the food really helps in the enjoyment. And Roger, can we city people who have lost that connection still find a joy like your friends do who enjoy your hams?
I think so. I believe that there is an enormous sub-economy that goes on in America, or maybe many, many sub-economies, because our land here is not really suitable for gardening. It's sand hills, sand, and I'm not much of a gardener. But I have this network, so that yesterday I got a bunch of maple syrup from a friend in Indiana who sent some, and I have a friend in Vermont who sends me ramps here in a couple of weeks from that area. I've got a friend in California who sends me almonds when they harvest their almonds. And there's this, and I send out dried sweet corn. I send out wild plum jelly. There's wild lead plant tea, which is called Roaring Buffalo because it was ready to pick about the time that the buffalo were rutting here on the plains. And I pick it, cure it, dry it, and package it up, and I send it back to my friends. And there's this whole subculture of an exchange that's going on in
but
America.
Those are people who have made the connection.
That's right.
You know, they've made the connection. They've sought out people.
And that's what it takes. And perhaps that's what's missing in America. In entertainment, we expect things to be performed in front of us. We don't want to go through any effort. When just the smallest effort to go out to the countryside, for example, and see a farm auction, where the auctioneer is one of the last really great folkloric performers in America, you don't have to buy anything, just go out there and watch a good auctioneer in action, and you have gotten yourself a major performance. And that kind of thing, I think, with just a little bit of effort, you can do wonders. Here I'm in the middle of what everybody says is nowhere. It's where food hasn't been uninteresting until recently, when we've had a lot more immigrants, especially Hispanics, but now increasingly we've got even Sudanese restaurant in Grand Island, Nebraska, of all places. But Linda and I started an interest in sausage. So I started just kind of checking around, and I find these little sausage shops all over Nebraska, of all places, in a little town of 300 that has a deep Polish heritage. Here's Mashka's sausage shop, which is not as nearly as big as the my front room that I'm sitting in, probably measures 8 feet by 8 feet in the reception area. Wonderful sausages that come complete with stories. So you can't buy you can't buy sausages without laughing with Mashka as he tells sausage stories. And then you come home with maybe 6 or 8 sausage, whatever he's making that day or that week. Incredible. Just gourmet prizes. And I met the guy who made it. I know it's good because he's a neat guy, and I know he's taking care of people because it's people in his community who are eating his food. He's not going to send out anything that's going to poison his neighbors, friends, and fellow parishioners at the Catholic Church. And I think with just a little bit of adventure, whether it's going to an orchard or an almond farm or a vineyard, you're going to make that connection. Sitting inside a brew pub and looking at the mechanisms that go into the beer while you're drinking the beer is a part of that.
And you can't really buy that, can you? I mean, you can't buy it on the shelves of a supermarket. You can't get it in a fast food store.
And it's invaluable. It doesn't matter whether the beer in that brew pub or the wine from that vineyard or the almonds are more expensive, although they're liable not to be. Generally speaking, when you're dealing with your buying your produce directly from the farmer who grew it, the argument is going to be him saying, you shouldn't have to pay that much for these carrots. You know, I just grew them here. They didn't cost me that much. And you saying, no, I want to pay you what they're due. That's usually the argument, the bargaining that goes on there. And we're lucky enough, even though we don't have a garden, that we're within 10 miles of a major truck farm area where there are little stands along the road. And we know those people personally now, after all these years, and we buy an awful lot of stuff starting as soon as the peas and lettuce is ready to go in the spring, right down to the pumpkins and squash in the late fall.
So they really become your farmers.
That's right. And I love the idea of handing the money to the guy who grew it and not the people who packaged it.
Huh. Folks, this is The Food Chain. We're going to finish up with Roger Welsh when we come back from this quick break, and I want to ask him about his favorite man food. And perhaps you have a favorite man food, too. And is there really a difference between man food and woman food? This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here with Roger Welsh, the sage of Dannebrog, Nebraska, and the author of Digging In and Pigging Out. What fun. It's food. And it's here on The Food Chain. Right back. Welcome back, folks. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking with Roger Welsh, sage of Dannebrog, Nebraska, and author of Digging In and Pigging Out, and a whole bunch of other books. Roger, you've picked out a pretty interesting title, Digging In and Pigging Out, and what you're talking about is, of course, is just digging in and pigging out and enjoying food to the maximum possible extent. What is your favorite food, and why do you call it man food anyway?
Oh, boy, that's like asking me which of my children I love.
I know, a tough one, huh?
One of the
Let's just say, Roger, that you have your choice of man food for dinner tonight. What's it going to be?
I would go into my closet back here, and I would look at the shelves, and it whatever strikes me at that moment. See, now I'm facing this. It's 11:55 here right now.
Lunchtime.
And Linda's off shopping, so I'm about to step into the kitchen. And at this point, I don't know what I'm going to eat for lunch. But I'm thinking right now, I've got some Swedish round bread that I may smear a little bit of real butter on. And probably that will be enough for me. I mean, that just sounds pretty good. But one of the bets I've always had with Linda is that I would like to see her make bacon, lettuce, and tomato sandwiches every day for as long as it takes for me to say, enough. I would love to see if either they make bacon and lettuce and tomatoes that long for me to give up, or if the time would ever come. That is my favorite food. But I guess for man food, it takes fire. Linda, it takes a fire. That's
a fire.
The main thing. Linda says that men love fire and explosions, and the way I cook, I manage to combine the two.
And what can you do with a fire and explosions?
Well,
I'm thinking ribs.
Oh, I adore ribs. Oh, man, I like ribs. And I think in my book I have my gin and tonic ribs recipe,
yeah,
where you mix up a huge batch of gin and tonic with Schweppes tonic and really good gin and some limes, and then you chill it and you take it out of the freezer so it's really cold, and then you put it in a nice big glass so you can sit in the hammock with it, and you build a fire and throw the ribs on it. Then you drink a little bit of gin and tonic and drink a little bit more, and then you look and see if there's fire in the grill, and then you drink a little more gin and tonic. And that's my recipe for gin and tonic ribs.
And the ribs get to taste better and better and better. And Linda, of course, kicked you out of the kitchen because your marinade melts the kitchen floor, right?
Oh, she will. She said she has to redecorate every time I cook in her kitchen. So the time she found fish guts on the ceiling was the time that I was exiled forever. So I have my own kitchen now. I have a summer kitchen outside in the backyard, which is my separate building where I can build my fires and cook my lutefisk and whatever else that stinks like crazy, and the dogs appreciate it, so that's all I care about.
Well, let's talk. We have a couple minutes left, so let's talk about what we city people who, you know, we're very sedentary anymore. We kind of sit on our butts and stare at computer screens and, you know, shuffle paper from one side of the desk to the other. And how can we, you know, get some enjoyment out of food when, you know, when we don't exercise our body, we don't use our bodies all that much, and so hunger becomes kind of a different thing.
Well, in reality, that's me too. I sit in front of a computer all day long. I'm a writer.
Right.
So I sit out there, even though I'm in a tin building and looking out over a river valley and in my 60 acres here on the Loup River, essentially I do the same thing. I think it is a matter of simply refocusing, that when you eat, you look at what you're eating and you think about what you're eating. It doesn't have to be something gourmet or even interesting, but when you think about the meaning of it and when you give a little thought to what's gone into that, when you do what you can to eat something that's interesting or drink something that's interesting, to try new things. And it doesn't mean that you have to go through a lot of work. It means simply that you explore grocery store shelves and maybe go into a different grocery, an ethnic grocery, a neighborhood grocery, yeah, where they carry things that are
so just have some fun, right, Roger?
That's folks, right. Folks, it's a matter of enjoying.
Folks, this has been The Food Chain, and that's been Roger Welsh, Digging In and Pigging Out. Get it, enjoy it. Thank you very much for tuning in.
Been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.